Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. When you think of the great rock bands of the 1990s, who comes to mind? Nirvana, of course. But how about Pearl Jam? They've got to be near the top of the list, if not number one. Eddie Vedder and his bandmates made an instant impact on the Seattle grunge scene when their debut album, 10, was released in August 1991. The band has gone on to sell over 85 million albums and are considered by many to be one of the best American rock bands of all time. They were recently inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Stephen Hayden is a music critic and the author of Long Road, Pearl Jam and the Soundtrack of a Generation. In his book, Stephen makes a solid argument for why the band continues to be relevant 30 years into their career. At the height of their fame, Pearl Jam was never afraid to be different. They balked at mainstream fandom and used their weight to support social issues and to publicly battle with Ticketmaster's excessive fees. And their notoriously dynamic live shows are still global crowd pleasers 3 decades later. And of course, there's the music, which struck a responsive chord, no pun intended, with Generation X. Stephen joined us from his home in Minneapolis to talk about the legacy of Pearl Jam, how they became the band of their generation, and how, much like Batman, the band's origin story never gets old.
I was talking about the Mama San tape, which is a famous demo tape that was sent to Eddie Vedder, and it included some of the earliest Pearl Jam songs, and that was basically his entree into the band.
Bless you.
You know, there's 3 songs on that tape. There's Alive, Once, and Footsteps. When those songs are performed together, they tell a story. You know, early on when Pearl Jam would perform those songs in sequence, Eddie Vedder, I think at one point he jokingly refers to it as like their Nutcracker Suite. You know, I think he was trying not to appear pretentious, but you know, in the book, I end up writing a lot about The Who and how The Who was a big inspiration for Eddie Vedder, and how, in a way, I think Pearl Jam modeled themselves after The Who. And obviously The Who, that's like one of their big contributions to rock history, is the rock opera. And that was Pearl Jam's version of it. Although it's interesting because on 10, Footsteps isn't on that record. You know, Once is obviously, and Alive is, but Footsteps isn't. And in my book, I give a little extra attention to Footsteps because that's kind of the black sheep of that trilogy. And that's always been one of my favorite Pearl Jam songs.
Yeah, Pearl Jam's 10 is one of the most successful debut albums of all time. Its popularity was certainly helped by MTV's heavy rotation of the music video for their iconic song, Jeremy. You described that video as a scathing critique of conformist mainstream American culture. Why?
Well, if you watch the video, you know, it's interesting seeing it now because it's easy, I think, to roll your eyes at it a little bit. It's very earnest and it's very over the top. But at the time, and especially me seeing it as a, you know, 14, 15-year-old kid, you know, you watch that video and, you know, they're showing kids pledge allegiance to the flag in a classroom, and then they intercut it with the kids doing the Nazi salute, you know? And it just opened up the world in a much bigger way, I think, back then.
At home, drawing pictures of mountaintops.
It was still kind of mind-blowing to see mainstream society being depicted that way. You know, it really, I think, was one of the things that for a lot of people, it started you asking questions about the way the world was. And maybe it wouldn't have occurred to you to ask those questions before that. MTV made them edit the video. So in the original cut of the video, you see Jeremy put the gun in his own mouth. So there's no doubt that it's a song about teen suicide. MTV cut that image out of the video, so when you watch the video, you see Jeremy with a gun, and then it cuts to all of these kids who are frozen, and they have blood on them. And it confused the message of that song, where people took it as a song about a school shooting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting looking at the consequences of that, because there are images from that video that ended up recurring in videos taken by future school shooters.
Mm.
You know, and this is through no fault of Pearl Jam. It's because of the censorship of the video. And I guess the idea was is that they didn't want to show a teenager taking their own life. But in doing that, they arguably made it worse. Actually, not even arguably, they did make it worse.
Jam followed up 10 with Verses, and there are a few songs on the Verses album that showcase Eddie Vedder's empathy for underdog characters.
You know, what's interesting about Verses is that this is 1993 that the album comes out, which is really the time like when alternative rock is reaching critical mass. And part of the appeal of alternative rock, and I think Verses specifically, is that it is a confrontational album. And I think a lot of the songs on that album are about questioning different things in the world, whether it's, you have like police violence in a song like WMA. You have a lot of songs written from the perspective of women on that record, which I think is like was a pretty incredible thing for Eddie Vedder. I think even in alt-rock spaces that were progressive, it was still like a pretty male-dominated world. And I think Eddie Vedder, more than a lot of people, really wanted to be inclusive with women. I just wanna scream hello. My God, it's been so long. Never dreamed you'd return. But now here you are. For Eddie Vedder, this rock singer, you know, one of the biggest bands in the world, to write a song like that, I think it really does show that he wasn't going to just repeat the standard rock and roll tropes. You know, most guys in his position would have been singing about, you know, scoring women on the road, or, you know, getting drunk, or, you know, living the rock and roll lifestyle. And here's this guy singing about, you know, an older woman working in a store and reflecting on her life. I mean, that's a pretty profound thing to do, I think.
You say that Pearl Jam's third album, Vitology, is very much dominated by Eddie Vedder's diseased headspace. Can you explain what you mean?
You know, that record is so fascinating because, you know, it's an album that sold, I think, 6 million copies in America, and yet you have some truly demented songs on that record. You know, you have famously the song Bugs, which Eddie Vedder joked about making that the album's first single, and it's just him not even singing, sort of doing this drunken, demented call about bugs while playing an accordion.
Bugs in my ears, they're eggs in my head. Bugs in my pockets, bugs in my shoes.
You know, you have like this 8-minute sound collage, which is reminiscent of like Revolution Number 9. But then you also have incredibly commercial songs like Better Man and Nothing Man and Corduroy. You know, Corduroy being like one of the most played songs in Pearl Jam's catalog. And, you know, when I was talking about his diseased mind, I just think that there's a sense of schizophrenia on that record. It's the conflicting impulses that I think were really afflicting Vedder specifically, but I think the whole band. And 30 years later, or you know, close to that, like when you revisit that record, I think that's what's so fascinating about it, that they really walk a tightrope between accessibility and like chaos on that record.
Mm, yeah, definitely. After the release of Vitalogy, it's impossible to overstate just how big Pearl Jam was and how important they were to mainstream culture. Then the Ticketmaster saga came, and you say that this effort is the single most misunderstood aspect of their legacy. How so?
Well, at the time, you know, they were really criticized for going after Ticketmaster because it really made seeing Pearl Jam live inconvenient. At the time, I mean, they refused to play Ticketmaster affiliated venues, which meant that they were playing a lot of sort of backwater type places. And I think for a lot of fans, they were just frustrated by that. So there was a lot of criticism in the media for this, and no one really kind of took the long view that Ticketmaster was a monopoly. You know, we look at what they were charging for fees at the time. I think Pearl Jam got upset because I think Ticketmaster wanted to add like $1.50 to a ticket or something, which seems like nothing now, but it was big at the time. And Pearl Jam wanted to take a stand on behalf of fans. There was not a lot of fan support for it.
One second, guys, listen to this. This band has spent the last year and a half putting together this tour with only one motive. And the motive was to do right by you, that no one else in the business had done. And if you owe them anything right now, you owe them your respect.
They were trying to do something about it. This was like one of the only bands that didn't just talk about being anti-establishment. They took like a substantive step to try to change the system. And they were on their own and they got crushed. And we can see now that things have just gotten way worse since then. So at the very least, I would like to think that when people look back on that, that they admire the attempt.
Mm-hmm. The tour that came out of the Ticketmaster battle ended up being a pivotal moment for Pearl Jam. You actually narrowed it down to a specific date. It's their show at Red Rocks on June 20th, 1995. What is the significance of that show?
The show people always talk about from that summer happened 4 days later in San Francisco. And it was a very famous fiasco because Eddie Vedder had food poisoning that day. I think he came out. They played in front of like 50,000 people. Like Neil Young was there. And after something like six songs, Eddie Vedder's doubled over and he can't sing anymore. In the moment, it really looked like the band might fall apart.
Thank you for coming out today. We're sorry that Eddie got sick and couldn't make it for this amazing day. And if we can make it back at the end of the tour at some point, we will. And other than that, enjoy the day. It's a beautiful day. And be well.
But of course, Pearl Jam, in the long run, they ended up persevering and carrying on. And now they're like one of the only bands of their cohort that has survived. I mean, when you listen to the bootleg, especially like the first, say, quarter of the show, you really hear Pearl Jam trying to do something that is not them. They're throwing all these different things against the wall. They play a version of Jeremy that like cuts out the chorus, essentially. You know, the most anthemic part of the song, they cut it out. They try playing this Nick Cave song and they can't get through it because they just learned it backstage and now it falls apart. And then there's this song that I focus on in my chapter. It's called Falling Down. And it's a song that they only played once live and never again. And it's a beautiful song. It sounds like a song that if they had polished it a little bit, it could have been a big radio hit. And for whatever reason, they opted not to do that. So we just have this one recording.
Yeah.
to me, that just felt like a metaphor in a way for what I think Pearl Jam became, which was not this big radio band, not this big band on MTV, but a band that makes its reputation night after night. A band that goes from city to city and tries to play an honest, spontaneous show that's unique to that moment. And then they're going to try to do something unique the following night. And I think that's the reason why there's so many people that are committed to this band, people that follow this band around the country, people that collect bootlegs and they know all the trivia and minutia of this band, because there's this possibility that if you see him tonight, you might see something you never seen before.
Right, yeah. The biggest tragedy in Pearl Jam's history happened at a Danish music festival called Roskilde. Can you tell us about that?
This was a festival in Europe that had a really good reputation for not only safety, but just being like a well-run festival. In the particular year that Pearl Jam played in 2000, you know, they had taken precautions to like reduce the crowd size to make it safer. And it's just like this weirdly freakish thing, like where all of these factors come into play to create a tragedy. You know, Pearl Jam's on stage, it's raining, it's a wet grounds. You know, there was a situation where people got trampled at this show and, you know, a bunch of people died. I think it was 9 people died. You know, again, to bring up The Who, I mean, they had a similar thing that happened to them, of course, in Cincinnati and at Riverfront Stadium in 1979, where a bunch of people were trampled at that show. Pete Townsend ended up giving Eddie Vedder advice at this time. You know, one of the things Pete Townsend always regretted about The Who's tragedy with fans being killed is that they left, which it just seems crazy that a band would have played the next night. Townsend was very direct with Vedder and just saying, look, you have to stay there and you have to help the people get through this, or, you know, you're always going to regret it. I mean, I think it was probably in his character to do that anyway. It seems like whenever the anniversary of that concert comes up, Pearl Jam always acknowledges it. They always talk about the victims. I feel like a lot of artists would maybe try to sweep this under the rug.
So 10 years ago in Denmark today, it was 10 years ago today, it was a completely different experience. And it was it continues to be the hardest day in our lives. And everyone who was there agrees. And it's not like we're thinking about it anymore today, because it's really something we've thought about every day. And we just want to...
I think Pearl Jam has always been pretty straight on in confronting grief and trauma in a way that seems very healthy. And I think it's helped to sustain them over the long haul.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Pearl Jam had a huge impact on Generation X. What do you think Pearl Jam's legacy will be to new generations?
You know, that's an interesting question, because I feel like Pearl Jam, I think the jury is still out yet on what their relevance will be to younger listeners. Is this going to be a band like The Who or Bruce Springsteen that younger generations feel almost obligated to listen to because they're so important to music history? Or are they going to be looked at as like a 90s band? I don't know the answer to that question. And there's a lot of fascinating aspects to who they are that are undersold that I think would be compelling to people who have heard Evenflo a million times and maybe they're sick of that song. But, you know, there's like a lot of other stuff to Pearl Jam that I think is compelling. And I hope this book helps to draw that out.
I think it will be the case. So, Stephen Hyden, thank you very much for joining us, and congratulations on Long Road.
Great. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Stephen Hyden is the author of Long Road, Pearl Jam and the Soundtrack of a Generation. Find out more at wpr.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Sheng Wang, Lena Crow, and Stephen Hyden.
You know how much homework I missed because of you? I loved your radio show. That was the best.
Beta is available on Apple Podcasts or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Don't forget to offer a rating or to share with new alphas. And you can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRbeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
Just go with it, Steve. What do your instincts tell you to do?
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
What Adam loves is the hunt.
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
He is not Mr. Sensitive Ponytail Man.